this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, "The Sweet Taste of Success. Japanese candy maker Morinaga is systematically breaking into the U.S. market from Orange County with a goal of increasing sales by 400% in 5 years. The question is, will the U.S. chew?" And the article begins on the headlines on the outside, but the article begins inside with a second headline. "The Candyman is here. Japanese candy maker establishes foothold in Orange County." And this article is written by Richard Rogoski. To understand the importance of having a new manufacturing facility in North Carolina, one simply has to look back at the past decade and tabulate the thousands of jobs that have disappeared from the payrolls of furniture makers, drug producers, and metal products finishers. But Morinaga and Company's newest $48 million candy manufacturing operation is interesting not because it's creating enough jobs to make a dent in the state's manufacturing woes, but because of what a company official say, that its Orange County plant will play a pivotal role in driving sales up 400% in 5 years. No, that's not a typo. 400%. Just how a company of Morinaga's size can achieve a 400% cumulative 5-year sales growth may sound overly optimistic to many. To achieve that kind of stratospheric success, one either ramps up its sales territories by creating multiple touch points, or uses technology in a fashion that creates more products and more variety at an affordable price. Morinaga, one of Japan's largest confectioners, with $3.82 billion in annual sales, is going the latter route. Armed with the company's belief that Americans will love its chewy, fruit-flavored candy, called Hi-Chew, that sales growth doesn't seem unreachable to the company's Japanese parent. "People won't buy what they don't know," says Kita Morinaga, the great-grandson of the company's founder and Morinaga American Foods Secretary Administration Manager. "Once people try Hi-Chew, they'll love it." Ramping up secretive operations. Beyond the business strategy, Morinaga is betting that America's love for candy will float the company's Orange County boat. Morinaga American Foods Incorporated, a subsidiary of Tokyo-based Morinaga & Company Limited, recently completed construction of a 120,000-square-foot facility in Mebane, just inside the Orange County line. The plant is situated on 21 acres off Ben Wilson Road, overlooking Interstate 40 and 85. It's Morinaga's first candy-producing plant in the U.S. Hi-Chew is the only product that is being manufactured at the plant. Although the company produces more than 100 different flavors of Hi-Chew, introducing a new flavor about every 6 months, the Mebane plant is currently producing only grape, strawberry, mango, and green apple. Morinaga says that while the plant is only running 2 shifts right now, it is still producing about 1 million pieces of candy per day. Ranked as the number one candy in Japan, Hi-Chew is slowly becoming popular in the U.S., company officials say. Local stores that carry this brand now include Walmart, Costco, Harris Teeter, and Lowe's Foods. It also is available at its Sugar and World Market at the streets of South Point Mall in Durham. But how volume, quality control, and diversity of the product will be maintained is simply anyone's guess. Morinaga officials are sensitive to the plant process because of competitive reasons. Kita Morinaga says the technology used in the plant is proprietary and therefore cannot be disclosed. All production workers, who also are sworn to secrecy about the technology, are being trained by instructors from the Hillsborough campus of Durham Technical Community College. Orange seeing green. Morinaga says there are now 85 full-time and temporary workers manning the 2 shifts. The goal, he says, is to ramp up to 3 shifts with 90 to 100 employees. The average employee salary is $37,969, and hiring preference is given to Orange County residents. Under terms of a North Carolina Department of Commerce block grant, which allows up to 75% or $750,000 for the county's total infrastructure costs, at least 60% of total jobs created must directly relate to Orange County employees who are at moderate or low income levels, earning no more than 80% of the county's median income of $37,950 before being hired by the company. While many Japanese companies operating in America prefer to retain a Japanese management style and workplace customs, Morinaga says, "We consider this a U.S. company, and we will establish our management in a U.S. style." However, he did say that he hopes to create a work environment that incorporates some aspects of what he calls the Japanese mentality, such as an adherence to high-quality standards, and that should not be hard to do, he says. "Most of our employees are cooperative and eager to achieve goals." Morinaga also notes that the company's desire to be rooted in the U.S. means it will soon begin using juices from fruit grown in the U.S. rather than relying on imports from other countries as it now does. And if Haichu's popularity in the U.S. soars as expected, he says the plant site's 21 acres gives the company ample room to expand its operations, taking on the competition. While the U.S. is still the largest candy and confectionery market in the world, Japan ranks a close second. And of Japan's three competing confectionery makers, Haichu is the top-selling candy in the country. According to the National Confectioners Association, which annually ranks global candy makers, Morinaga ranks 25th out of the top 100 candy manufacturers in the world this year. But one of its major competitors, Meiji, also headquartered in Tokyo, now ranks 5th in the world. Morinaga admits that Haichu's biggest competitor in the U.S. is Starburst, another chewy, flute-flavored candy made by William Wrigley Jr. Company, a subsidiary of Mars Incorporated. But he says Haichu's popularity will grow once people become familiar with the product. "We have no history here," he states, adding that attempts to advertise Haichu through conventional advertising channels such as television have not been successful. Instead, they rely on giving out free samples at selected retail outlets. In the Triangle, the popularity of Haichu is growing. Maggie Spence, manager of It's Sugar in Durham, says, "We go through 30 to 40 cases a week." Spence says that while her candy store uses them as a promotion item, people who try them really like them. "They're popular with everyone and kids love them," she says. And for those candy lovers who have never heard of Haichu, Spence says, "Well, we tell them it's a Japanese Starburst." Another part of the company's manufacturing strategy has been to strike deals with professional sports teams. Since Morinaga America Foods sales office is in Irvine, California, the company first made Haichu available in the dugout of the L.A. Dodgers. Other baseball teams now chewing its fruity flavors include the Minnesota Twins and the Boston Red Sox. A long and varied history. The story of Morinaga and Company, a public company trading on the Tokyo Stock Exchange, and its subsequent startup of Morinaga American Foods Incorporated, is long and varied, but it all begins with Toshiro Morinaga, who was born in 1863. Finding work with a wholesale company on Yokohama, the young Morinaga extended too much credit to customers and, in an attempt to repay his employer, moved to San Francisco in 1887 and opened a hardware store. When that business failed, in part because of anti-Oriental sentiment at the time, Morinaga moved back to Japan. But his stay in America led him to discover two things that would shape the rest of his life: candy and Christianity. While in San Francisco, he learned how to make candy and found that many in the Japanese community loved marshmallows, which were known as angel food. Upon his return to Japan, Morinaga founded Morinaga Western Candy Confectionery and opened a small shop in Tokyo, selling both marshmallows and the more novel caramel, which he had also learned to make. He set out to perfect a caramel recipe specifically designed for the Japanese market and climate. In 1914, he called this new chewy product Haichu. But as early as 1905, with marshmallow sales skyrocketing and his conversion to Christianity leading him to serve as a missionary, Morinaga adopted an angel as the company logo. Keita Morinaga says even through all the financial and emotional hardships his great-grandfather endured in America, his newfound faith got him through it. In time, the angel logo also became a symbol for the delicious, fun, and healthy foods the company strives to produce, Keita Morinaga adds. In 1918, the company produced the first chocolate candy bar in Japan, and by the 1930s was promoting holidays to increase candy sales. Over the years, the company added new production equipment, and in the 1950s introduced ice cream and a hot cake mix. In the 1980s, with sales reaching $1 billion, the company continued to expand its product lines, and in 1983 signed a licensing agreement with U.S.-based Weider Nutrition International to develop and market health food products in Japan. But the company also began looking beyond its own shores, and in 2004 established a manufacturing facility in Shanghai to target the more than 1.3 billion people in mainland China. The Road to Mebane. Steve Brantley, director of Orange County Economic Development, says his office was contacted on February 1, 2012, by the North Carolina Department of Commerce concerning a site search called Project Rainbow for an unnamed company. That company, Morinaga and Company, was looking for a North American location for a new manufacturing plant. The initial search, Brantley says, included sites in Portland, Oregon, Ontario, Canada, Philadelphia, Richmond, Atlanta, and 18 sites in 12 counties within North Carolina. In April and May, representatives from Portland-based site selection consulting firm Inspect Group and Morinaga and Company Limited visited Orange County, triggering a closed-door meeting of the county commission to discuss possible incentives. By that time, there were only two sites seriously being considered by Morinaga, and Brantley became the point person for Orange County. I was the person who represented Orange County in 2012 when the firm and its consultant traveled to North Carolina and the Southeast scouting sites, he says. My prior 23-year career as the Japanese and Asian industrial project recruiter for the North Carolina Department of Commerce was a coincidence to this project being Japanese. However, my background did give me and Orange County a bit of an advantage over our competition with respect to understanding the Japanese culture and how to best pursue such Japanese prospects. This was a very competitive multi-state site search, he continues. The final two locations were ours and a place outside Atlanta. This firm was considered to be the very first industrial recruitment meeting held by Governor McCrory, who met the Japanese one day before he was sworn in as the new governor. In addition to the Community Development Block Grant, the state offered the company a $264,000 grant from the One North Carolina Fund, which requires a match from Orange County and the town of Mebane. The North Carolina Department of Transportation agreed to extend Ben Wilson Road at a cost of $750,000, and Orange County agreed to offer a performance-based grant of up to 75% of the taxable value of the company's $48 million capital investment over the first 5 years. This translates to between $1 million and $1.5 million. Additionally, the town of Mebane offered its own incentive of up to $720,000 spread over the first 5 years. Duke Energy extended power lines, and PSNC Energy extended natural gas lines to the site at no cost. And Durham Technical Community College committed $150,000 or more if necessary for the training of new employees. For North Carolina, Morinaga's U.S. success is only solving part of the puzzle. Governor Pat McCrory, in making economic development announcements in the past 4 years, always has voiced state government support to emphasize the importance of diversified manufacturing base. This is an over 100-year-old company, McCrory said of Morinaga at the groundbreaking ceremony just 2 years ago. It has a pioneering spirit, which is great, which is a great fit for North Carolina, because we are pioneering people, and we're people of high ethics and high value, and we're hard workers. This commitment demonstrates that North Carolina has the right mix of great workers, solid business environment, good quality of life. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by digital producer Mark DeRoberts. The first headline, work on material sciences led to DeSimone's White House honor. Joseph DeSimone, the noted professor and entrepreneur who teaches at NC State University and at UNC Chapel Hill, received the National Medal of Technology and Innovation from President Barack Obama on May 19. Wow, humbling, DeSimone tweeted the day he received the award. DeSimone won the award for pioneering innovations in material science that led to the development of technologies in diverse fields, from manufacturing to medicine, and for innovative and inclusive leadership in higher education and entrepreneurship. He was one of 17 of the nation's top scientists and innovators received either He was one of 17 of the nation's top scientists and innovators received either the National Medal of Science or the National Medal of Technology and Innovation. Local brews, distilleries claim spotlight. The North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services and Got to Be NC hosted buyers from around the globe on May 23 at the J.C. Ralston Arboretum at NC State University. Many exporters from Brazil, UK, Japan, India, and China were there looking to add some North Carolina craft beer, wine, and shine to their overseas portfolios. On hand to pour samples during a reception were many statewide vendors, including Lone Rider, Big Boss, Rail House Brewery, Stevens Winery, Topo Spirits, Fortnite Brewing, Rayland Vineyards, and Great Wagon Road Distilling Company out of Charlotte. During the reception, former U.S. Ambassador to Denmark, Jim Kane, was seen mingling with vendors. Kane made his way toward Raylands' Vineyards wine display and chatted with General Manager, winemaker Steve Shepard about his wines. Biz overheard Kane tell Shepard that the Category 5, a full-bodied Cabernet blend by Rayland, was his favorite. Eateries join hands to support Food and Wine Festival. The four-day Raleigh Food and Wine Festival ended May 22 with its grand tasting event at the historic Melrose Knitting Mill and Babylon Restaurant. The space was filled with more than 40 vendors serving plated samples, drinks, and merchandise. Some of the participating restaurants included 18 Seaboard, Dos Taquitos, Zoco, Mandolin, Midtown Grill, Rise Biscuits, and Rye Bar and Southern Kitchen. And if you were looking to whet your appetite, you didn't have to go far, as shops such as the Raleigh Wine Shop, Sanctuary Vineyards, Raleigh Rum Company, and Kettle One were pouring many libations. The event, which celebrated its second year, is the brainchild of Samad Hatchby of Babylon Restaurant and Lisa Jeffries of Raleighwood Media Group. Media gets down to fight for charity dollars. It was a down-home celebration at Wendell Falls during the annual barn raising on May 21. The afternoon featured model home tours, live music, food, craft beer, and the Hoedown Showdown, a square dance competition featuring some Triangle media personalities. Media outlets such as WRAL, Time Warner Cable, News 14, Indie Weekly, The News and Observer, and FoodScene.com took part in the competition, with $1,000 going to their favorite charity. Once the dust settled and the Hoedown music played its last note, it came down to just two. Bethany Wright, a producer at Time Warner Cable News 14, was runner-up, and the grand prize winner went to local foodie photographer Felicia Perry of FoodScene.com. Perry's donation of $1,000 will go to the local Cystic Fibrosis Foundation of Raleigh. local execs partner to support TCA initiatives. Raleigh travel app Yulio has partnered with Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend of The Who. Well, sort of. The route-based mobile app developer is joining with Raleigh's First Citizens Bank to provide travelers with enhanced awareness of a charity founded by the artist Teen Cancer America, or TCA. When users open Yulio, the app shows them events and activities along their travel routes. And now, thanks to the partnership, users will see a short pop-up promotion for TCA. As users create their routes, they'll see First Citizens Bank locations with ads supporting the bank's TCA fundraising and awareness campaign. In other TCA-related news, Biz was told that local PR and advertising agency, French West Vaughn, is joining hands with the TCA as a pro bono partner to provide the agency with brand awareness services. FWV CEO Rick French says he wanted to help make Roger and Pete's vision of installing a teen cancer ward in every major city in the United States a reality. Charity picks five soldiers, military groups for donation. Playing golf to help the wounded warriors. Once again, folks at EDM Americas and Enable America are joining hands to raise money for a few U.S. veterans by hosting an annual golf tournament at Prestonwood Country Club on June 6. The tournament organizer, Arun Singh, tells Biz the outing has raised some $400,000 in the past 5 years. This year, the charity has identified five individual soldiers, the National Guard, Enable America, and Make-A-Wish for U.S. military families as recipients of the proceeds. So for Singh, so far, Singh notes about 280 golfers have registered to play in the tourney. Major General Greg Lusk, the Adjutant General of the North Carolina National Guard, and former Iowa Governor Chet Culver are expected to be at the event. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, time for 400 more apartments. Williams Kane draw up new plans for Raleigh. Williams Realty and Building Company in Raleigh has not traditionally been known to be an aggressive investor in big new real estate development. Over the past few years, though, the company and its president, Cross Williams Jr., have been quietly buying up many of the aging retail and office buildings at the corner of Peace and Northwest Streets on the north side of downtown Raleigh. Some of the property has been under Williams family ownership for more than 40 years, and some of the tenants have been there just about as long. But the first clues to Williams' new vision for the site began to surface in fall 2015 when he, in a joint venture with North Hills developer John Kane, bought the Southland Ballroom and ThemeWorks buildings on West Street under an entity dubbed WK Smoky Hollow LLC. Smoky Hollow was the name of the historical blue-collar neighborhood that used to occupy that area of Raleigh before redevelopment efforts took over in the 1960s. Kane, not known for being conservative in his ambitions for expensive mixed-use development projects, on May 20 officially unveiled a rendering of a new plan for the site. The sketch shows a 12-story cluster of buildings that will have more than 400 high-end apartment units and a yet-to-be-determined amount of street-level retail. It would be valued at close to $100 million when completed. Kane says that no retail tenant commitments have yet been signed for the project. However, real estate sources say the partnership has received a verbal commitment from the Publix supermarket. That chain, the Florida-based grocer, has been pushing to expand its footprint across North Carolina the past few years, and downtown proponents have been working to attract a new grocery store in the downtown district. The building project would be timed, Kane says, to correspond with the North Carolina Department of Transportation's plan to tear apart and realign the Capitol Boulevard Bridge that crosses over Peace Street near the Kane Williams project. This is a pretty complicated project with a more than a 2-year build-out, he says, but we think it'll be timed pretty well. between this, the work that NCDOT is doing, the new park the city is planning across the street, it will transform that area of town. It's a real game changer. Kane says the Glenwood South project still needs the site plan approval from the city, but that if all goes well, the demolition and the site work could start as early as first quarter 2017. Kane credited Williams with having the foresight to begin the land assemblage years ago. "We have all the land we need under control already," he says. Four new parking decks. Durham leaders get serious about growth. At its work session on May 19, Durham City Council evaluated a new recommendation by staff to not delay the start of construction for a $23 million seven-story parking deck at the corner of Mangum and Morgan Streets. It is one of four new parking deck projects that both Durham City Council and the Durham County Board of Commissioners have already started budgeting for over the next 3 years. I believe they should be budgeting over for the next 3 years. The projects combined would add about 3,200 new parking options for downtown workers and visitors. Durham County Commissioners are also evaluating a public-private partnership plan to build an even bigger parking deck with close to 1,000 spaces on the 500 block of East Main Street. Longfellow Real Estate Partners in September was approved for a $5.25 million incentive package to help pay for the construction of a 820-space parking deck to support construction of two new office buildings in the newest phase of the Durham Innovation District on Durham ID. And the owners and developers of the Chesterfield building have also been approved for up to $6 million in incentives over 15 years to build a 544-space parking deck to support the parking needs of its office development project. Advance Auto Parts CEO tips hat to Sloan family, promises substantial improvement. It's been a bit of a trial by fire for Tom Greco, the newly appointed CEO of Advance Auto Parts. He's been on the job for less than 40 days and had to break the news to Wall Street on May 19 that the company of about 74,000 employees had missed its revenue projections for the first quarter by a lot. The day before, it was announced that a new chairman would be taking over Advance Auto's board of directors. Activist hedge fund investor Jeff Smith and five of the company's board members would not be reappointed. Among the group, the board of members, among the group of board members not returning, is former General Parts International president Temple Sloan. But Greco still took an opportunity during the first investor conference call with investors on May 19 to give kudos to both Sloan and his father, General Parts owner O. Temple Sloan Jr., as well as Arthur and Nick Taubman, founders of the first Advance Auto Parts stores. Temple Sloan Jr. was way ahead of his time when he forced General Parts and ultimately CarQuest, before he founded General Parts and ultimately CarQuest, Greco said. In addition, I would like to personally thank the Taubman and Sloan families for being so incredibly welcoming to me as I've assumed this responsibility. Greco said he and his leadership team, including the Advance Auto president, George Sherman, are in the midst of developing a strategic plan to improve profitability in the company. Changes could include the implementing of more field-centric organization with less dependence on the store support centers in Raleigh and at headquarters in Roanoke, Virginia. Bainbridge pays $3 million for Morrisville land, new luxury apartment project. Florida-based multifamily real estate development firm, the Bainbridge Companies, has acquired a nearly 10-acre site on Evans Road in Morrisville. The group paid $3.2 million for the 9.7-acre site at the southeast corner of the intersection of Evans Road and Aviation Parkway, according to county real estate records. The plan, says Bainbridge Senior Development Director Ginger Akis, is to build a 200-unit luxury apartment complex down the road from MetLife's Global Technology campus in Cary and Lake Crabtree. Construction should begin in June. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, where sports meets tech. Durham's Teamworks blossoms local ops with 850 clients. Teamworks, the Durham tech startup founded by a former Duke University football lineman, continues to hear yes a lot. In the past year, it has grown from 20 to 30 employees, moved into office space in downtown Durham, and expanded a client list to more than 300 NCAA Division I programs, including more than 70 football bowl subdivision programs at nearly 50 Power 5 institutions. In total, the company has more than 850 clients, including a contract with Adidas. Now, Major League Lacrosse, the top lacrosse league in the United States, signed on as well. It's an exciting time at Teamworks, and we're growing faster than ever. We've settled into our new office downtown and are pleased by the rapid expansions made to our space, our staff, and our client list, says Zach Morides, Teamworks founder and president. The Teamworks software helps organizations put a large group of disparate individuals on the same schedule. It's obviously not the only web-based scheduling platform. Think of Microsoft Outlook, for example. But is the only one tailored intentionally for athletic programs. While playing at Duke, I saw firsthand how Teamworks can help streamline communication and operations for an entire organization. More than 10 years later, it's rewarding to see Teamworks relied upon daily by the best athletic institutions all over the country, says Morides. Triangle Hospital show drop in investment returns profitability. The poor investment returns felt across many industry sectors are hitting the profit and loss statements of Triangle area hospitals as well. Operationally speaking, the Triangle's major health systems report in good health. So far in their respective fiscal quarters, all four major hospitals have an operating margin of at least 5%, with the Duke University Health System leading the way at more than 10%. Duke, UNC hospitals, and Rex operate on a July to June fiscal year, but WakeMed Health and Hospitals fiscal year begins October 1. All financial reports used in this analysis are unaudited and relate to the obligated group of each hospital, not the system as a whole. And in a section called By the Numbers, 32, Holly Hill Hospital filed paperwork with the state auditors to add 32 adult inpatient psychiatric beds in Wake County. If approved, it would add much-needed services for mental and behavioral patients and drug and alcohol abusers. 13.2 percentage of residents of all ages in North Carolina not covered by any kind of health insurance, either private or public. That's down from the rate of 20% in 2011, but still ranks 47th in the nation. $3.8 million. Combined net losses from Lenoir Memorial Hospital in Kinston in fiscal years 2013 and 2014. UNC Healthcare reached a management services agreement with the hospital. And in the section called He Said It, the quote, "We believe that hospital systems, while necessary, are really a part of the problem." And that's from Levi Boyd, Advance Care Director of Finance and Business Development. Advance is a group of private practice physicians who want to remain fiercely independent. Boyd says hospitals are necessary for high levels of care, surgery, emergency, and the like, but are very expensive places to receive day-to-day care. Avance will open its eighth location on June 1 in Apex. And finally, withdrawn. Durham drug developer Viamet Pharmaceuticals withdrew an initial public offering again. The company had filed plans with the Securities and Exchange Commission to raise roughly $80 million through an IPO. This marks the second time the company filed an IPO but withdrew plans to go public. In 2014, Viamet also filed to go public, but decided to pull that offering and instead raised $60 million from private investors. And now we turn to the On Matters and Tech page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, Bonner Bridge Project Well Underway. When building a 2.5-mile bridge across an unpredictable inlet, nerves are high, particularly when there's $246 million at stake and you've got cranes hoisting tens of thousands of tons of concrete. Such is the case with the state's Bonner Bridge project. The baby of Pablo Hernandez, NCDOT's lead engineer on the project, also known as the guy whose job it is to make sure the effort meets its 2019 completion date. The bridge, which will span the Oregon Inlet, broke ground in March with the first pilings installed in May. The biggest challenge thus far isn't the litigation that delayed construction in court for so many months. It's the weather, already causing delays on the ground. Take an instance of a barge that recently carried an enormous crane from the multi-billion Tappan Zee Bridge project in New York. Its size meant the equipment had to be transported down the Atlantic seaboard by way of a 108-foot-wide barge. The opening through the existing bridge is 112 feet, and Hernandez was the guy tasked with guiding it through with just a few feet to spare. That meant a very, very nervous Hernandez in a boat on a foggy Saturday morning guiding the two tugboats bringing in the barge. And that was just one task on a seemingly endless list as crews compile their tools and materials. Some cranes have to be transported via trucks in pieces, anywhere from 5 to 10 truckloads, and assembled on site. His team recently installed what he calls an elevated work platform that's about 20 feet off the ground, a space that will eventually serve as a 1.5-mile long work bridge for cranes to travel on as they install materials. And that, like most everything else out here, is being installed piece by piece. In all, he expects the project to require up to 12 cranes. The piling installed last week weighs 68 tons. And to complete the project, his team will be installing 676 pilings of varied size. Put them all together, and they would stretch more than 16 miles. There's so many numbers with this project, he says. And in a section called Big Numbers, 32, the number of entrepreneurial companies in the technology, life sciences, and clean tech sectors to raise financing in the first quarter, according to numbers released by the Council for Entrepreneurial Development, or CED, $169 million. Combined, these companies raised $169 million from 45 unique equity investors. CED President and CEO Joan Seaford Rose called it a solid performance, even though it's the lowest funding total for a quarter since the third quarter of 2014, when companies only raised $85 million. It's also the weakest start to the year since the first quarter of 2013, when companies inked $82 million. Silicon Valley's WalkMe picks Raleigh to head up Tech Outfit's regional headquarters. WalkMe, a California tech upstart focused on social engagement, picked Raleigh over competing cities Austin, Texas, Nashville, Tennessee, and Denver, Colorado, for an expansion that CEO Dan Adika says means hundreds of new jobs downtown in the coming years. Already, the company has 10 employees at a downtown Fayetteville Street facility, with plans to have that headcount at 40 to 50 employees by the end of the year, Adika says. And from there, the growth at the factory, being called a regional headquarters, will continue, he says. Not that he expects it to be easy, even with the proximity of the university-fueled talent pool. Hiring is hard, especially in the beginning, Adika says. You want to build the right kind of culture. You don't want to grow too fast. You want to build a good infrastructure. WalkMe, which has more than $40 million in financial backing, was secured for Raleigh after months of conversations between the company and local economic development officials, such as Adrian Cole, Wake County Economic Development Executive Director. She says House Bill 2, the contentious piece of legislation, faulted for PayPal's decision to pull a 400-job expansion from Charlotte, never even entered the conversation. They saw the strengths and assets of this community and saw that this was where they wanted to be, she says. County and city officials were joined by the Capital Area Workforce Development Board, the North Carolina Community College System, North Carolina State University, and the Research Triangle Regional Partnership in their recruitment efforts. Bayer says yes, but Monsanto says no. After what executives described as years of confidential discussions, Bayer announced May 23 that it had tendered an official offer for Monsanto. A day later, Monsanto announced it had officially rejected the bid, though execs said via a prepared statement that they were open to having more discussions. The bid, at least as Bayer first envisioned it, valued the company at $62 billion and would have moved Bayer's RTP-based North American Crop Science headquarters to St. Louis. Via multiple statements, Bayer stressed that its commitment to RTP was solid, deal or no deal. We've invested more than $150 million in RTP in recent years and intend to maintain that significant presence in the area, says Bayer spokesman Jeffrey Donald. Private equity could sell Sensus for $1.7 billion. A Raleigh clean tech that is developing advanced metering technologies for utility companies could be the subject of a $1.7 billion deal. Multiple reports indicate that Sensus USA's private equity firm owner since 2003, the Jordan Company, is working with Goldman Sachs Group and Credit Suisse Group on an auction for the firm. Neither Sensus nor the Jordan Company are commenting publicly on those reports. Sensus has 3,240 employees across the globe, including more than 670 in North Carolina. And finally, in the section called By the Numbers, increased money flow from out-of-state investors. 14, the number of tech companies raising equity financing, a combined $52 million. 17, the number of life sciences companies raising equity financing, $113 million. 1, a clean tech company raised nearly $4 million in the quarter. 37, the number of out-of-market investment funds funneling money in North Carolina companies in the quarter. 5, the number of international investors participating in deals. 11, the number of investments from California investors. 8, the number of investments in North Carolina companies from in-state investors. And finally, 11, the number of entrepreneurial companies involved in mergers, acquisitions, or buyouts in the first quarter. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where first we read the viewpoint of Susan Milner Parrott, who is an attorney at the Smith Anderson Law Firm in Raleigh. The headline on her viewpoint, Employers, Do You Need to Reclassify Some Workers? On May 18, the U.S. Department of Labor, DOL, announced the publication of the much-anticipated final rule updating the overtime regulations under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, FLSA. In 2014, President Obama directed the DOL to modernize the regulations governing the executive, administrative, and professional exemptions. A proposed rule was published in July 2015, and the DOL received nearly 300,000 comments on that proposed rule during the two-month comment period. The final rule, which will be effective December 1, 2016, raises the salary threshold level required for exemption from overtime as an administrative, executive, professional, outside sales, or computer employee, the EAP or white-collar exemptions. The FLSA requires that workers be paid a minimum wage for all hours worked in a work week and no less than 1 1/2 times the worker's regular rate of pay for hours worked over 40 in a work week. However, the FLSA provides certain exemptions from these requirements. In order to be exempt from minimum wage and overtime as an EAP employee under the FLSA, the employee must satisfy three tests. One, the employer must be paid a fixed salary that is not subject to reduction because of variations in quality or quantity of work performed, the salary basis test. Two, the salary must be of an amount at least equal to the specified threshold amount salary level test. And three, the employee's primary job duties must be those duties delineated in the regulations applicable to each of the EAP exemptions, the duties test. The key provisions of the final rule relate primarily to updating compensation levels for EAP workers. According to the DOL's fact sheet, the rule sets the standard salary level at the 40th percentile of earnings of full-time salaried workers in the lowest wage census region, currently the South, which is $913 per week or $47,476 annually for a full-year worker. Sets the total annual compensation requirement for highly compensated employees, or HCEs, subject to a minimal duties test to the annual equivalent of the 90th percentile of full-time salaried workers nationally, which is $134,004, and establishes a mechanism for automatically updating the salary and compensation levels every 3 years to maintain the levels at the above percentiles and to ensure that they continue to provide useful and effective tests for exemption. A significant change created by the final rule is that now, for the first time, employers may use non-discretionary bonuses and incentive payments, including commissions, to satisfy up to 10% of the required salary threshold for employees other than HCEs. In order to credit a non-discretionary bonus or incentive payment toward a portion of the salary level, such payments must be paid on a quarterly or more frequent basis. The employer is permitted to make a catch-up payment at the end of the applicable pay period. The final rule did not create any changes to the duties list. The DOL stated that the standard duties test and the HCE duties test both remain unchanged, it being the department's belief that as a result of the change to the salary level, the number of workers for whom employers must apply the duties test to determine exempt status is reduced, thus simplifying the exemption fact sheet. What employers should do now? Employers should determine which of their employees who are currently treated as exempt are receiving salaries below the new threshold amount, $47,476. Once this group is identified, the employer should determine whether it would be better to raise the employee's salary to $47,476 to maintain the exemption or to reclassify the employee as non-exempt. employers may want to consider committing overtime expenses by decreasing hours worked as reassigning duties to spread work among employees. If an employer reclassification reclassifies employees, the employer should consider whether formerly exempt employees may need training on timekeeping and compliance with employer policies, such as use of email after regular work hours. In addition, employers may want to consider how best to communicate any required changes to minimize any adverse effect on employee morale. And the other letter to the editor we have is written by Charles Mast of Smithfield. The headline, how about CSX in Four Oaks, neighbors? In an attempt to learn more about my Four Oaks neighbors, I rode down and visited with one of the families whose land could potentially be used by CSX for its intermodal terminal, now being considered for Four Oaks instead of Selma Micro, and which is less than 6 miles as the crow flies from my home. There are indeed several families and children that would have to relocate if the terminal goes there. Undoubtedly, those families love their neighbors and community, and they clearly do not want to have to uproot themselves and go elsewhere. I am sure I would not want to move either. I have also learned that there are others in the exact same community who are dealing with extreme hardships that many of the rest of us do not know about. They really need the money being offered by CSX for their land. And if it happens, it would be a tremendous blessing and would be life-changing for them. Lastly, I have learned that there are even others in the community who would prefer to sell to CSX, but because they still live there and do not want the main anti-CSX families to know, they have yet to obligate and have even put up signs against CSX in their yards. The CSX issue has bounced back and forth over the last several months. I think the concerns about what kind of neighbor CSX would be to adjoining landowners were mostly answered by the local group that went to Ohio and visited the exact type of facility that would come here. Most of them will tell you that they would be fine with it being in their front yard. If others in the affected community would like to go visit, I understand there are people willing to pay for that to happen. Ultimately, I guess the question is, what would you do, or what would you do if you had this decision to make? I believe that in Johnston County, our neighbor is not just next door or across the street, but our entire county. If I could turn around Eastern Johnston County economically by selling my land, I pray that I would do so even without any extra money or benefit to me personally. But again, that's just me, my conscience, and how I believe. Our northern Johnston County neighbors felt differently, irrespective of how much money they already had in their pockets or how much extra money they were being offered. That was their call, and I am not the one to judge them. In Four Oaks, CSX is offering to buy land for four times the actual worth and buy homes for twice their worth. How about letting CSX come to Four Oaks, neighbors? If you want to stay in the community, I am sure that some of your other neighbors will sell you land at a much cheaper price than what CSX is offering you. You can actually put others first, stay there, and make money. And now we turn to the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Melissa Sargent. She's the Chief Marketing Officer at Channel Advisor. Stepping into what she calls her dream job, Melissa Sargent has been named Chief Marketing Officer at Morrisville-based Channel Advisor. In her new role, Sargent is responsible for overseeing the company's worldwide marketing initiatives, including corporate and product branding, demand generation, public relations, product marketing, and event management. I'm excited about leveraging my background in developing go-to-market strategies for software-as-a-service companies to elevate awareness for Channel Advisor's leading e-commerce platform, she says. Previously, Sargent served as Vice President of Marketing for tax compliance automation firm Avalara. Channel Advisor is a publicly traded 600-person e-commerce software company that works with approximately 3,000 retailers and branded manufacturers to help them sell product on e-commerce channels such as Amazon, eBay, and Google. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? In the last 10 years, marketing has completely changed. Marketing has transformed from a creative discipline to one that is highly analytical and data-driven. Today, a modern marketing organization has a seat at the table in the company because marketers have a deep understanding of the markets, the segments, the buyers, and the customers. These critical insights can influence every part of the business. What are some of your major goals for your new position? As a marketing organization, our goal is the same as the company's goal, to help drive profitable growth for Channel Advisor. Biggest worry? At this point in my life and career, I have learned that worry is counterproductive. So I don't spend cycles worrying because it doesn't help me personally or professionally. I also run every day to help manage stress, keep focus, and stay healthy. Triangle Area business person you most admire? Sylvia Aguirre, Chief Certificates Officer of Avalara. Sylvia and her husband, Matt McNeil, founded Tax Technology Services, which was acquired by Avalara in 2013. Sylvia and Matt also own Clouds Brewing in Raleigh. Personal, husband Bob, two dogs, Ozzy and Piper. Last book you've read, Disrupted by Dan Lyons. And finally, we'll mention the Business Survey Pulse poll that was taken. The question, are you planning an international trip out of RDU this year? The respondents, 77% said yes, 23% said no. And we're going to go ahead and stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.